Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, May 25th, 2025. These days, we all need a good laugh. From the January 2025 issue of Scientific American, the origin of joking, evolution, studies of great apes hint at why and when clowning behavior evolved, by Erica Cartmill. One sunny afternoon in San Diego, 3-year-old Aisha played outside while her father sat nearby. Her father wasn't paying much attention to her, so Aisha took a toy and waved it at him. When he didn't respond, she redoubled her efforts, gently bonking him on the head with the toy. She looked at her dad's face expectantly, but to no avail. Aisha then waved the toy in her dad's face and brushed it across the top of his head, making it harder and harder for him to ignore her. Finally, he gave in and watched while she swung on a swing. Like most 3-year-olds you might know, Aisha could be a handful. Unlike those 3-year-olds, Aisha is an orangutan. She is 11 now, and she and her family live at the San Diego Zoo. Throughout her childhood, Aisha spent her days playing, eating, sleeping, and frequently bugging her parents. Aisha's behavior toward her father probably sounds familiar. You're likely to see similar behavior from a bored toddler and her father in a supermarket checkout line. Where does this urge to bug, mess with, or tease others come from? Is the similarity between Aisha's behavior and that of a human child merely a superficial resemblance, or is it the result of deep commonalities in the way we play, learn, and think? Over the past several years, my colleagues and I have been studying teasing in humans and great apes to figure out why and when this behavior evolved. Teasing exists in a gray area between play and aggression. It can sometimes lead to bullying and ostracism, but it can also be loving and even endearing. For humans, playful teasing, which includes clowning, pranking, and joking, provides a wonderful space to learn about social relationships. It can test those relationships by gently stretching the boundaries of social norms and seeing what one can get away with. And it can advertise the strength of those relationships to others. Imagine watching a group of friends playfully insult one another. We think much the same is true for the other great apes. Although scholars have traditionally viewed humor as a uniquely human trait, our findings suggest that it has surprisingly deep roots. I first started thinking about the origin of humor in 2005, when I was researching orangutan communication for my PhD. I was at a zoo studying how orangutans use gestures to communicate. One day, I witnessed a fascinating interaction that I didn't know how to categorize or analyze. An infant orangutan was dangling from a rope over her mother, who was lying on her back in a pile of straw. The infant extended a large piece of bark toward her mother, and her mother reached for it. At the last second, the infant pulled the bark back out of her mother's grasp. Her mother lowered her hand. The infant offered the bark again. This, here, take it, oops, just kidding, behavior happened a few more times until the infant dropped the piece of bark. To my surprise, the mother then picked it up and started doing the same thing back toward the infant. This role reversal was intriguing. Now it wasn't just a tolerant mother going along with her daughter. It was a game, or maybe a joke. It had the core features of a joke, a setup, the offer, and a punchline, the withdrawal. Surely it wasn't a great joke. It wouldn't appear in anyone's stand-up routine, but it seemed like the kind of joke a toddler might enjoy. Young children find repetitive physical jokes incredibly entertaining. The humor centers on a moment of surprise, something unexpectedly happening. And yet, these interactions are typically repeated over and over. The unexpected moment becomes an unexpected part of the game. Peekaboo. This kind of expected surprise is the basis of a lot of humor. Jokes often involve a conventionalized setup. Knock, knock. What's the deal with? Did you ever notice how? What's the difference between? The framing primes the listeners for a punchline, letting them know they should listen to the language that follows in a less literal way. Children begin creating these unexpected moments before their first birthday, even before they say their first word. Vasu Reddy, a psychologist at the University of Portsmouth in England, calls these interactions clowning behaviors and highlights three common types: offer and withdrawal, disruption of others' activities, and provocative non-compliance, intentionally doing something that violates a norm or rule. A human infant might offer an object and pull it back at the last second, just as I saw the infant orangutan do. They might demonstrate non-compliance by putting a shoe on their head, like a hat, instead of on their foot, smiling as they do so. An infant's primary motivation for clowning seems to be engagement with others, not violation of rules. These are playful social behaviors. Youngsters frequently laugh while clowning and look toward the faces of the adults for a reaction. The exchange between the infant and mother orangutan wasn't immediately relevant to what I was researching at the time, but it stuck in my mind, along with other instances of teasing that I occasionally observed while studying gestural communication in this species. Eventually, my research focus shifted, and I got more and more interested in the cognition that drives communication. I began to think about those teasing interactions I had witnessed. They weren't necessarily part of the communication systems I had been studying, but they involved understanding the minds of others. It occurred to me that those behaviors could provide an interesting lens on the evolution of social intelligence. Orangutans and humans are both great apes, along with chimpanzees, bonobos, and gorillas. Members of this group have many things in common. We have big brains and long childhoods. We laugh, mourn, get jealous, and hold grudges. We recognize ourselves in mirrors and understand that others can know things we don't. Great apes have well-developed social intelligence. We are very interested in other individuals, and we spend a lot of time playing with, learning from, fighting over, getting even with, and befriending them. Could playful teasing have evolved as part of this intense interest in the goals, feelings, and relationships of others? Getting at this question would require systematically observing the great apes for the presence of teasing behaviors, something that, to my knowledge, no one had done before. In early 2020, I assembled a team of students, postdocs, and colleagues, including Isabel Laumer, Johanna Eckert, and Sasha Winkler, all then at the University of California, Los Angeles, and Federico Rossano of the University of California, San Diego, to conduct this research. We initially planned a series of hands-on studies in zoos, but the world had other plans. Like humans, the other great apes are susceptible to COVID, so at the height of the pandemic, the primate research community paused all research that involved interacting directly with great apes. We decided to carry out a video-based study instead. Using footage of orangutans, gorillas, chimpanzees, and bonobos in zoos in the U.S. and Europe, we identified social interactions that appeared to contain a mix of playful and annoying elements. We explicitly avoided any cases of pure aggression or pure play so we could focus on the gray area in between. Social cognition is difficult to study, particularly in animals as complicated as great apes. Researchers studying humans can use questionnaires to ask people what they think about others' intentions or beliefs. But studies of non-human apes and human infants must measure subjects' thinking without language. For example, by observing and coding natural interactions or by measuring the behaviors individuals produce when presented with sounds, images, or puzzles. We developed a coding system for teasing that builds on those used to study ape communication. Behavioral coding systems are the most common way to study interactions between animals or people when you are observing them from a distance. They consist of a set of codes, basically labels, and a set of rules about how to apply those codes. Systematic application of the codes, according to the rules, turns messy real-world interactions into quantifiable variables that can be analyzed statistically. It also can be used to confirm that behaviors seen by one person are also seen by others, giving researchers a way to bolster the reliability of their observations. This approach helps to ensure that the phenomenon is not merely in the eye of the beholder. In developing our coding system, we made sure to include things such as the identity of the teaser and target, the teaser's actions, whether the teaser waited for a response from the target, whether there were any repetitions of behavior, and whether interactions were primarily one-sided or reciprocal. We also coded for elements of play, including facial expressions, gestures, relaxation, and evidence of mutual enjoyment. For instance, both parties willingly continuing an interaction. Three of us worked together to code categories, apply them, discuss them, revise them, and apply them again. We repeated this process several times until we were happy with the coding system we had developed and satisfied that we were all applying it in the same way. Our final coding system identified five main characteristics of playful teasing: a provocative behavior, a mainly one-sided provocation, an element of surprise, such as the teaser approaching the target from behind, a look from the teaser toward the target's face, and repetition or elaboration of the provocative behavior. Very few of the examples we observed had all five of these traits, but 129 examples had at least three of the five. The most difficult teasing characteristic to define, and arguably the most important, was the presence of provocative behavior. It was reliably coded the same way by different people, so we knew it could be identified, but it was hard to put into words. We ultimately decided that the best definition was something that was difficult for the target to ignore. This could involve the teaser doing something very slowly or very quickly, directly in front of the target. It could involve shaking or pounding on something the target was sitting on. It could even involve the teaser leaning into the target's face until they were almost touching. These behaviors have very different forms, but they are all things that could be difficult to ignore. The four kinds of great apes we studied live in very different social groups and natural environments in the wild. Orangutans are largely solitary and spend most of their time up in the trees. Gorillas live on the ground in social groups made up of one adult male and multiple adult females and young. Chimpanzees and bonobos spend time both in the trees and on the ground, and they live in big communities composed of multiple males and multiple females. But whereas chimpanzees have male-dominated societies with relatively high levels of aggression between adults, bonobos live in mostly matriarchal societies and tend to respond to conflict not with fighting, but with sex. Despite these profound differences in their ways of life, all four species playfully teased one another in largely similar ways. They poked, hit, pushed, pulled, and tickled one another. There was a lot of swinging and waving of arms, legs, and objects. A teaser might grab another's hand or foot to stop their activity. Sometimes apes hid under objects when teasing, popping a hand out to pull someone's hair or somersaulting into another individual while inside a burlap sack. On one occasion, a juvenile chimpanzee named Azebo approached his mother while she was grooming another chimpanzee and smacked her on the back, then retreated and looked at her from a safe distance. The juvenile repeated the provocation multiple times. The mother ineffectually swatted the air in response, gently grabbing toward Azebo while continuing to groom the other ape. This kind of behavior is different from regular play. When two apes play, the interaction is more symmetrical. They approach each other and stay together while they interact, or they chase each other. Azebo's repeated provoke and remove to a safe distance pattern is playful, but it is also provocative, a characteristic of teasing. Young apes were more likely to tease than adult apes, but adults teased too. In another interaction, Azebo had a stick that he was using to try to get into a feeder. Every time the youngster tried to insert the stick into a hole in the feeder, an adult named Sandra blocked his attempt by covering the hole or by grabbing the tool and then dropping it on the ground. Sandra didn't want the tool for herself. She just wanted to tease Azebo. Teasing actions were used in ways that appeared specifically intended to elicit a response from the target. Apes weren't just treating others as part of the environment. They were expecting an interaction. During and after teasing actions, apes looked at the target to gauge their response. They then repeated their actions or elaborated them. A poke might turn into a hair pull. Waving a toy might turn into a bonk on the head. This provocative, persistent, escalating teasing seems incredibly irritating, but the response of other apes were almost never aggressive. Targets tended to ignore teasers or try to gently shrug, wave, or shoo them away. Sometimes they responded positively, reciprocating with play, an embrace, or teasing of their own. Other times they just got up and left. Apes were typically relaxed before teasing began, and teasing did not agitate either the teaser or the target. Although teasers were trying to goad their targets, they were doing it in a low-stakes way. Playful teasing most likely happens during periods of boredom, not stress. Think of kids in the back seat on a road trip. That's an ideal environment for teasing. The presence of playful teasing in all four of our great ape cousins suggests that it benefits them in important ways. We can look to this behavior in humans to see how it might be advantageous. Playful teasing provides a rich opportunity to learn about others' minds. The teaser has to predict the target's response and adjust their behavior based on how the target is likely to respond. Things that might be received well by a close friend would not be by a stranger. You can call your best friend a slut, a punk, or a weenie, and they might playfully insult you back, but you are unlikely to get the same response from your boss or a tax auditor. Even within close relationships, friendships, someone's response might vary from day to day or from hour to hour, depending on the person's mood and your previous interactions. Learning to predict how others will respond to you is a critical skill for highly social animals like humans and other apes. Who will have your back if you get into a fight? Who will give you the benefit of the doubt if your actions or intentions are ambiguous? Playful teasing provides a relatively low-risk environment in which to develop and refine your social prediction skills. Being able to predict and understand the goals, intentions, knowledge, and desires of others is the basis for human language and culture. Although non-human apes do not have language, they do share some of these foundational skills, and playful teasing provides a window onto them. Most animals play, but playful teasing may offer an opportunity to move from physical to mental play, from playing with bodies to playing with minds. We're only just beginning to understand teasing and how it relates to social cognition in creatures other than humans. Can apes predict whether someone will be surprised? My colleagues and I are using methods such as eye tracking to study what apes pay attention to when watching others interact. Do apes get excited when they anticipate a strong reaction in a social interaction? We are using thermal imaging to measure changes in blood flow around the eyes and ears, a physiological sign of excitement. When we expect a social scene may be funny, scary, or exciting to an ape. We're still collecting and analyzing data for these projects, but a small pilot study using thermal imaging with bonobos suggests at least some apes get excited when they see another ape get tickled, for instance. By combining biological measures such as eye position and blood flow with behavioral measures such as an ape's preference for different partners in a game, we can develop a more complete picture of how attention, memory, mood, and prediction combine when apes are thinking about others. Although playful teasing has been systematically studied only in humans and other apes, we suspect that other animals do it too. If it provides a way to build, test, and show off relationships, as well as an opportunity to practice predicting others' behavior, then we might expect it to evolve in other highly social animals with big brains, few predators, and long childhoods. Parrots, dolphins, elephants, whales, and dogs are all good candidates. Our group is studying a few of these non-primate species, but it will take many more observers to get a clear understanding of what playful teasing looks like across the animal kingdom. To get more people involved, we recently surveyed zookeepers in more than 100 zoos, and we are now collecting stories about animal teasing from folks around the world. If you have stories or recordings of animals playfully teasing you or other animals, we invite you to share them on our website, www.observinganimals.org/teasing. Getting a big picture of playful teasing across the animal kingdom will inform how we study the origin and evolution of this behavior. Already, observations of teasing in all the great ape species suggest the roots of human humor may go back 13 million years or more to the last common ancestor of Aisha the orangutan and the bored child in the checkout line. They may not get a Netflix comedy special, but teasing apes provide strong evidence the first joke is far older than the early human who extended a hand in the firelight and said, "Pull my finger." And the scientist, whose studies of great apes hint at why and when clowning behavior evolved, Erica Cartmill, is a professor of anthropology, cognitive science, and animal behavior at Indiana University, Bloomington. She studies the evolution of cognition and communication. And her article about her study appears in the January 2025 issue of Scientific American. On meds, you may be able to eat grapefruit again someday. Scientists have identified a gene that causes production of a substance in some citrus that interferes with many medications. By Veronique Greenwood, posted on January 10, 2025, a New York Times trilobite. You may be among the millions of people who have seen a surprisingly specific warning like this on the labels of drugs you take. Avoid eating grapefruit or drinking grapefruit juice while using this medication. Such warnings are issued for dozens of substances, including docetaxel, a cancer drug, erythromycin, an antibiotic, and some statins, the cholesterol-lowering drugs, prescribed to more than a third of American adults over 40. The problem is a set of molecules, furanocoumarins. High levels of furanocoumarins interfere with human liver enzymes, among other processes. In their presence, medications can build up to unhealthy levels in the body, and grapefruits and some related citrus fruits are full of them. But there is no such warning for other kinds of citrus, such as mandarins and other oranges. Citrus researchers at the Volcani Center in Israel reported Wednesday in the journal The New Phytologist that by crossing mandarins and grapefruit, they've uncovered genes that produce furanocoumarins in some citrus fruits. It's a finding that opens the possibility of creating grapefruit that doesn't require a warning label. Scientists have worked out the compound's structures and pieced together a basic flowchart of how they are made years ago, said Yoram Ayel, a professor at the Volcani Center. But the precise identities of enzymes catalyzing the process, the proteins that snip off a branch here or add a piece there, remained mysterious. He and his colleagues knew that one way to identify them was to breed citrus high in furanocoumarins with those without. If the offspring of such a cross had varying levels of the substances, it should be possible, by digging into their genetics, to pinpoint the genes for the proteins. We were afraid to approach it because it's very time-consuming and it takes many years, he said, noting how involved it can be to grow new trees from seeds and assess their genetics. But finally, we decided we have to dive in. When they examined the offspring of a mandarin and a grapefruit, the researchers saw something remarkable. 50% of the young plants had high levels of furanocoumarins, and 50% had none. That particular signature meant something very specific in terms of how the ability to make these substances is inherited. We saw there was only one gene that could have controlled it, said Livnat Goldenberg, a Volcani Center researcher who is the lead author of the new study. The researchers soon identified the gene controlling the production of furanocoumarins in leaves and fruit, which produces an enzyme called 2-oxoglutarate-dependent dioxygenase, or 2-OGD for short. Mandarins, it turns out, have a mutated form of this gene that keeps the enzyme from functioning properly. This version cropped up in all the mandarin and orange varieties the researchers checked, explaining why they do not cause the same problems as grapefruit in people taking prescription medications. In these plants, furanocoumarin production is paused. With gene editing technology, it should be possible to alter the gene in grapefruit as well, Dr. Ayal suggests. The team at the Volcani Center is now exploring that project. Looking at how widespread this mutated version is in mandarins and some other citrus, the scientists speculate that some gene nearby on the genome must play an important role in a highly prized trait. A long-ago citrus breeder, selecting for some unknown quality, must have unwittingly spread this furanocoumarin-busting version of the gene to an ancestor of modern varieties of mandarins and oranges. All these years later, that person's work is coming to light under the gaze of geneticists who may someday put grapefruit back on the menu. And that's the New York Times Trilobite. On meds, you may be able to eat grapefruit again someday. Scientists have identified a gene that causes production of a substance in some citrus that interferes with many medications. How to boil an egg. A New York Times trilobite posted on February 6, 2025, written by Alexander Nazarian. How to boil an egg? Scientists claim to have cracked the recipe. Their new method takes 32 minutes. A colleague approached Ernesto Di Maio, a materials scientist in Naples, Italy, and an expert in plastic foams, with a blunt suggestion: you should do something cooler. The colleague had a project in mind, Dr. Di Maio recalled. He wanted a perfectly boiled egg. The task was harder than it might seem, as many home cooks know. The yolk and the egg white, or albumin, have different chemical compositions, which call for different heating temperatures. Dr. Di Maio and his colleagues also welcomed the chance to one-up the Michelin star chef Carlo Crocco, an egg evangelist who charges $52 for an egg yolk dish at his restaurant in Milan. The scientists devised a way of cooking an egg that requires no special culinary skill or fancy gadgets. It took about 300 eggs, though the researchers didn't eat all of them, said Pellegrino Musto, a polymer expert at the National Research Council of Italy. The researchers said their method, published a few weeks ago, preserves the distinct textures of the egg, as well as its nutritional value. The two parts of the egg require different cooking temperatures because they have different chemical components. The albumin is mainly composed of water and proteins, said Emilia Di Lorenzo, a graduate student in Dr. Di Maio's lab at the University of Naples, Federico II, who recently published a paper on foaming pizza. Yolk, on the other hand, is much richer in nutrients. Hard boiling an egg is a popular approach that calls for at least 10 minutes of immersion in boiling water. That is long enough for the yolk to be thoroughly cooked, but it's also plenty of time for the albumin's proteins to unfold and clump, expelling water molecules as they become heated. The approach can also create a green ring around the yolk, which indicates the presence of smelly ferrous sulfide. Many times people say that they don't like the rubberiness of the egg white or the graininess of the yolk in a hard-boiled egg, said Nelson Serrano Barri, a chef and the director of innovation at the American Egg Board, the egg industry's main trade association, which has lately been dealing with soaring prices and worries about the bird flu. A soft boil, on the other hand, needs a much shorter cooking period. That keeps the albumin from turning hard, but may also keep the yolk too soft. Ms. Di Lorenzo explained that the yolk is rich in lipids, which, when heated, become more fluid. Though some people prefer a runny yolk, others find it revolting. A third method, known as sous vide, cooks an egg for an hour in a water bath of 150 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the ideal temperature for the yolk, but the prolonged exposure is less optimal for the albumin because the water is not hot enough to denature its proteins. Ms. Di Lorenzo was blunt about the sous vide approach. It's runny. I am not a big fan. The scientists' new method, derived with the help of fluid dynamics software, calls for alternating between boiling and lukewarm water. The egg gets 2 minutes in 212-degree water, followed by 2 minutes at 86 degrees, with the cycle repeated 8 times. Dr. Di Maio explained that the average temperature of the two immersions, 150 degrees, is ideal for the yolk, while the hotter bath is sufficient to cook the albumin. The very key of our method is to have a well-cooked albumin without wasting the yolk, Dr. Di Maio said. Relative to the other methods, the periodic baths did a better job of preserving the egg's nutrients, the study found. The authors noted a higher concentration of polyphenols, compounds that protect against DNA damage. It's probably brilliant, but who is the method for? Asked Deb Perelman, who runs the popular Smitten Kitchen blog. For home cooking, there's always a necessary balance of perfect versus a reasonable effort. Her preferred foolproof method involves a long ice bath after the egg is cooked. In a recipe for the New York Times, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt proposed steaming the egg in a single inch of water. It's a matter of taste, Ms. Di Lorenzo said. If science is universal, food is deeply personal. Some people even eat raw eggs. There is one big drawback to the new Italian technique. It's more difficult to peel the periodic egg because everything is softer, Dr. Di Maio said. But Mr. Serrano Barri said that the egg board was on the case. We are running a study to figure out that, he said. I could have an answer for you in the coming months. This New York Times trilobite, published on February 6, 2025, reports on the ongoing search to answer the question, how to boil an egg. And speaking of eggs, this next New York Times trilobite explains that snakeskin isn't just a fashion statement for birds. A museum curator with a ladder showed that birds that build cavity-style nests are able to protect their eggs with the skin shed by snakes. Written by Kate Golombievsky, this was originally published on January 25th and updated on February 3rd, 2025. In 1889, the naturalist Alan Octavian Hume wrote that he was puzzled by macabre decorations he observed in many birds' nests, strips of dried snakeskin. Are birds superstitious, I wonder? Do they believe in charms? He wrote, in the nests and eggs of Indian birds. If not, why were so many birds using pieces of snakeskin to adorn their nests? Hume and several of his contemporaries had a hypothesis. The snakeskin scared away predators. A new study suggests that they were onto something. After analyzing century-old records of birds' nests and observing over 140 nests with and without snakeskin, researchers reported in January in the American Naturalist that in some types of nests, the presence of snakeskin greatly reduced the risk that predators would take the eggs. All reptiles shed patches of dead skin as they grow, but snakes shed skins off their entire bodies in one big piece. However, finding a snakeskin in the wild can be tricky, said Vanya Rower, a curator at the Cornell University Museum of Vertebrates and an author of the study. This scarcity of snakeskin makes it all the more remarkable that so many birds use it in their nests. How in the world are they finding it? And why do they invest all that time to bring it back to their nests? Dr. Rower said. He delved into digitized historical records of birds' nesting behavior, including handwritten observations of nests from over a century ago. He and his colleagues determined that cavity nesters, birds that build their nests in holes in structures like trees and cliffs, are 6.5 times more likely to incorporate snakeskin into their nests than species that create more classic cup-shaped nests. Based on this information, Dr. Rower devised a series of experiments to try and understand what the benefits of shed snakeskin might be. He surveyed the microbes and larger parasites in nests with and without snakeskin to see if the skin warded off critters like fleas and mites or reduced the nest's harmful microbes. There didn't seem to be any correlations. The other idea that we looked at was a nest predation idea, Dr. Rower said. In a forested area called Monkey Run near the Cornell campus in Ithaca, New York, Dr. Rower put quail eggs into 65 nests boxes, which are like cavity nests, and 80 empty robin's nests, which are open cup nests. He added snakeskin to half of the nests and spent the next several weeks checking on them with a ladder. My wife nicknamed me Ladderman, he said. During his stint as Ladderman, Dr. Rower found something surprising. While the snakeskin didn't seem to make much difference to the safety of the eggs in the open cup nests, the scaly scraps made a big difference in the nest boxes. The cavity nests with snakeskin had a much higher chance of surviving a 14-day incubation period compared to a cavity nest without snakeskin, he said. In particular, snakeskin seemed to deter small mammals like mice, which are known to take eggs. This discovery suggested additional questions. What is scary about snakeskin? Is it the smell of snakeskin? Is it the sight of snakeskin to these small mammals? Dr. Rower said. Ross Crates, an ecologist at the Australian National University, who was not involved in the study, noted that other research had shown that some birds hissed to ward off predators to their nests. Pretending that there's a snake in the nest in some way is beneficial for these small, hole-nesting birds that have less capacity to actually physically defend the nest against larger, mostly mammalian predators, Dr. Crates suggested. Dr. Rower said that nests had been overlooked in scientific research, in part because they can be difficult to observe and study. Digitized data sets like the ones he and his colleagues used are helping researchers to make discoveries. We're only now just starting to really look at some of the unique materials in birds' nests, he said. And this New York Times trilobite, posted on February 3rd, 2025, tells us that snakeskin isn't just a fashion statement for birds. A museum curator with a ladder showed that birds that build cavity-style nests are able to protect their eggs with the skin shed by snakes. Our next article also comes from the New York Times, posted on February 16th, updated on February 17th, 2025, by Emily Anthes and the photographs by Emily Elonen. On a mission to heal Gila monsters. After years in big pharma, a chemist pivoted to help save the species that made Ozempic possible. By any measure, the diabetes drug Ozempic has been a blockbuster, racking up billions of dollars in annual sales. In the United States alone, pharmacies fill millions of prescriptions for Ozempic and related drugs, which have become popular for their weight loss effects, every month. But in the beginning, before the celebrity endorsements and the think pieces and the global supply crunch, there was just a strange venomous lizard with a flair for intermittent fasting. The Gila monster, which is native to the deserts of North America, can survive on just a few meals a year thanks to a digestion-slowing hormone in its venom. The discovery of this hormone paved the way for Ozempic, making the Gila monster an enormously profitable gift to modern medicine. And last summer, one particular Gila monster, a former pet named Pebbles, needed medicine in return. Pebbles, a resident at the Creature Conservancy, a wildlife education organization in Ann Arbor, Michigan, had been infected with a parasite called Cryptosporidium. Hard to kill, the parasite colonizes the digestive tract and is typically a death sentence for reptiles. A veterinarian had recommended that Pebbles be humanely euthanized. But the Creature Conservancy wasn't ready to accept that fate for Pebbles, who had at least another decade of life potentially ahead of her. If he can fix her, said Steve Marsh, the founder of the Creature Conservancy, one afternoon last July. He nodded toward a sharply dressed man who was cradling Pebbles in his gloved hands. Tim Cernak, a pharmaceutical chemist at the University of Michigan. A few minutes later, a veterinarian inserted a tube into the lizard's throat, collecting liquid from her stomach. Later, Dr. Cernak would study this sample in his lab, hoping to isolate the parasite and find a drug that could vanquish it. Pebbles was not the patient Dr. Cernak had in mind when he began his career. Until 2018, he had worked at the pharmaceutical giant Merck, developing drugs for people with cancer, HIV, diabetes, and other conditions. Along the way, he had helped develop cutting-edge approaches involving robots and artificial intelligence to speed up the invention of new human drugs. A few years ago, however, Dr. Cernak decided that he wanted to use these tools to make medicines for ailing plants and animals, forging a new field he called conservation chemistry. Gila monsters weren't the only species that had inspired human drugs. There were antibiotics derived from fungi, anti-cancer drugs from plants, and painkillers from animal venom. Dr. Cernak thought it was time for pharmaceutical chemists to give back. To me, it's this full circle thing, he said. We're attempting to solve the ultimate health inequity. Conservation chemistry. Dr. Cernak, a native Canadian, had grown up catching leopard frogs and crayfish at his grandparents' lakeside cottage in Quebec. When he left his job at Merck, he wanted to use his chemical expertise for a greater environmental good. Pharma's red, said Dr. Cernak, who has a youthful face and the upbeat energy to match. But I wanted to apply my talents to a love of nature. Initially, he thought he might do research on methane, a greenhouse gas contributing to climate change. But after COVID-19 hit, he began to think more about the existential population-level risks posed by disease. A fungal disease called chytridiomycosis, or chytrid, was driving frogs to extinction. Bald eagles and elephant seals were succumbing to bird flu, and sea turtles were washing ashore with a contagious form of cancer. Treatment options left much to be desired. There were human medicines that could help some sick frogs and sea turtles, but they could cause severe side effects and were unsuitable only for certain animal patients. Dr. Cernak had experience developing targeted anti-cancer drugs, which were designed to destroy cancer cells while minimizing damage to healthy ones. Would it really be such a stretch to do the same thing for a tumor-riddled sea turtle? Precision oncology for a sea turtle, that could totally be done, he thought. The same idea could be extended to ecosystems. In some ways, the invasive, sap-sucking insects that were spreading through America's hemlock groves could be considered a cancer of the forest. Perhaps the tools of pharmaceutical chemistry could help him design a precision pesticide that would wipe out the invasive insects while sparing native ones. Dr. Cernak had a knack for seeing opportunities everywhere and a reluctance to do anything halfway. He began traipsing around hemlock groves at the university's arboretum and asking sea turtle hospitals for samples of tumor tissue. He puzzled over how to get anti-malarial drugs to rare birds in Hawaii and wondered, as just kind of a fun thought experiment, whether he could design monoclonal antibodies that selectively ferried poison to different species of invasive fish. And on a trip to the Creature Conservancy in December 2023, he learned about the plight of pebbles. Robo-drug discovery. Drug development is a famously failure-prone pursuit. Dr. Cernak has ratcheted up the degree of difficulty by focusing on pathogens and patients that are poorly understood. People haven't chosen to look inside of the Gila monster too much, he said. But that's exactly what his team was doing one day last July in a chemistry lab on the University of Michigan's Leafy campus. There are many species of Cryptosporidium, which can infect a wide range of mammals, birds, and reptiles. All of them are understudied, Dr. Cernak said, but the reptile pathogens are a particular mystery. And when the scientists put a sample from pebbles under the microscope, they were startled by what they saw. A single-celled parasite wrapped in a thick, jelly-like coating, an unexpected extra layer of cellular protection. It's like this citadel, Dr. Cernak said. Soon, they would begin looking for a drug to breach this line of defense. On another lab bench, however, the hunt for a better cure for chytrid, the amphibian fungal disease, was already underway. A modular robot in a transparent box glided back and forth, preparing to dispense minute doses of antifungal drugs into a grid of shallow wells. The short-term goal was to identify an existing drug that would be more effective and less toxic than one common chytrid treatment. The robots, the largest of which could run more than 1,500 chemical reactions at once, could quickly test a pharmacy's worth of possibilities on lab-grown chytrid cells. Over the months that followed, the team identified a compound, which Dr. Cernak declined to disclose, that proved promising in both the cells and in the African dwarf frogs that were paddling around in a nearby biology lab. The next step is to test it in additional species. The fact that Tim is moving into this from a field of human medicine is really awesome, said Brian Gratwick, who leads the amphibian conservation programs at the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute and is collaborating with Dr. Cernak, because that's one of the things that has been missing, that kind of focus, that kind of methodology, and the rigor that is being applied to humans. Into the wild. Over the longer term, Dr. Cernak is trying to engineer a new drug specifically for chytrid. He is using several AI-powered tools, including Google's Nobel-winning software AlphaFold, to visualize the three-dimensional structure of a critical fungal protein and design a drug that binds to it. He is using the same basic approach in his search for new drugs for bird flu and sea turtle cancer. A drug that is sufficiently precise, binding only to that chytrid protein, could potentially be dispensed directly into frog ponds. I kind of imagine those pucks that you put in the back of a toilet, Dr. Cernak said, a slow-release type thing. It's a vision he shares with some reluctance. I just really don't want to appear to be the mad chemist who's sprinkling chemicals all over, he said, particularly just because I think chemists are so easy to villainize in conservation. And so we're really trying to find the right way to get it to our patient with having the absolute minimal impact on the ecosystem. Indeed, the idea of deliberately releasing drugs into the environment is likely to make some conservationists uneasy. Pharmaceuticals were never designed to just be sort of broadcast out there, said Catherine Arnold, an ecologist at the University of York in Britain. Human pharmaceuticals, which regularly turn up in the world's waterways, are known pollutants. They can imperil aquatic organisms and fuel the emergence of drug-resistant pathogens. Even dosing animals individually wouldn't eliminate risk, said Thomas Broden, an ecologist at the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences. Medicated animals could excrete drugs into the environment, he said, or unwittingly poison predators. In India, vultures were nearly driven to extinction after scavenging on the carcasses of cows that had been given a common painkiller. Dr. Broden praised Dr. Cernak's optimism. His heart is in the right place, he said. But even in drugs in humans, we've seen how hard it is to design drugs that are very specific. There are likely to be regulatory and economic hurdles, too. Who exactly is going to pay for a precision cancer drug for sea turtles? And while novel drugs can help buy time for critically endangered species, protecting biodiversity will require addressing larger problems, including climate change and habitat loss. A lot of these diseases we're seeing are a consequence of changes in the environment, animals being stressed or their habitats being degraded, said David Duffy, a cancer biologist at the University of Florida's Whitney Laboratory for Marine Bioscience, who is also working on cancer treatments for sea turtles. What chemists and oncologists can do, he added, is mostly treating the consequences. Pills for pebbles. Dr. Cernak is clear-eyed about these challenges. He has been waiting for more than a year for the federal permits he needs to receive sea turtle tissue, and he has not been able to attract funding for the Pebbles project, even after approaching a drug company profiting from Gila monster-inspired drugs. We have kept the work alive on fumes, he said. Without funding, he could not culture Pebbles' parasite in the lab, which he needed to do before he could unleash the robotic drug testers. So his team used AI-based tools to scour the scientific literature on cryptosporidium, looking for potential treatments safe enough to try without extensive laboratory trials. My biggest fear was that I would overdose and poison Pebbles, Dr. Cernak said. He homed in on a drug that can cure cryptosporidium infections in livestock, but has yielded mixed results in reptiles. In December and January, Pebbles gobbled down 7 doses of the drug, which had been secreted inside dead mice and quail. So far, she has shown no ill effects, But because her digestive system moves so slowly, it could be months before the scientists know whether the drug worked. Dr. Cernak is bracing himself for the possibility that it won't. And then what? We'll try again, he said. This article was written by Emily Anthes, a science reporter writing primarily about animal health and science. She also covered the coronavirus pandemic. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.